This is Just the Right Book, and I'm Roxanne Cody of R.J. Julia Booksellers. Each week, I hope to bring to you the stories behind the books, talking with some of the very best contemporary nonfiction authors, books that are timeless and charming, provocative, and of the moment. The conversations you want to hear about the books you need to read. This interview that you're about to hear is probably quite different than maybe the other, I don't know how many I've done before, a couple hundred interviews, for a couple of very particular reasons. The woman I'm about to interview, Dr. Edith Ava Eger, is the author of The Choice and her new book, The Gift, 12 Lessons to Save Your Life. But the other thing that Dr. Eger is a woman who is the same age as my mother, was probably on the same transport as my mother from Hungary to Auschwitz. And it was an opportunity for the both of us to share an experience that I think I would have never thought I could have another chance to talk to my mother. And I don't think Dr. Eger quite expected to speak to someone who was the daughter of someone that she was in Auschwitz with. So I think you're in for a treat, and I think you're in for a very different kind of conversation. Dr. Edith Ava Eger, welcome to Just the Right Book. Was it that those who did survive have the DNA that gave them the resilience to survive, or was it some other undefined organic thing that contributed, like luck, to their survival?
I remember being 16 in love, and I had a tremendous will, determination. No matter what happens outside, they never gonna touch me and my spirit.
Mm. And you were that way then, before the war?
I was with a very, very beautiful ballet master who told me that God made me in such a way that all my ecstasy has to come from inside out.
Mm.
I didn't understand that word. And in Auschwitz, it came to me that I cannot change the outside, and I have to look within myself and look at life from inside out.
Mm.
Auschwitz was an opportunity for discovering your inner resources.
And among, as you call them, the girls that you knew in your bunker, you saw differences right away among them in Auschwitz right away in terms of how they thought.
Yes, they did. We knew exactly who's going to die because it was on their face, giving up. And we saw it. I remember that I was with a girl from Yugoslavia, and she said that we're going to be liberated by Christmas, and we were not. And she died the following day. Today I talk about perfectionism, that everything has to happen a certain way. And that's really not helpful to be a rigid person.
Mm-hmm.
It's better to be flexible. Better to be flexible. I lecture a great deal about the difference between a survivor and a victim.
Yeah. It's one of the questions that I was going to ask you, because my parents, both of whom are survivors, always describe themselves as survivors, not victims. And in reading your book, it made me wonder how does someone transform themselves from thinking of themselves as a victim to thinking of themselves as a survivor, or can they?
I think it has a great deal to do with the way they choose, the attitude, how to respond and not to react. Because when you react, you don't think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you fight or flee, which didn't work in Auschwitz at all.
Right.
Because if you touch the guards, you were shot. If you touch the barbed wire, you were electrocuted. You know, it was really a sense of curiosity that helped me survive. I always wanted to know what's going to happen next.
Mm.
I never even allowed myself to even think what they told me, that I will never get out of here alive, that the only way I will get out of here is a corpse. And today I teach my patients not to allow to take things personally and not to allow other people to enter and disturb your peace of mind.
Did you nonetheless have a moment of despair when you were in Auschwitz?
You know, I am very grateful that I was working with Vietnam veterans and I decided to go back to Auschwitz because I realized that I came to America and I went to school and I picked up all kinds of things, you know, diplomacy and this and that. But I had a 16-year-old girl in me that I ran away from. So today what I do is guide. I like to call myself a guide. And by the way, I don't see myself as a survivor. I see myself as a human being, that I'm fallible, I'm going to make mistakes. I happen to survive an experience, but it's not my being. It was done to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my identity.
And
I think your parents felt the same.
Yes. I mean, my parents rejoiced at so much. Our house, I would meet other children of Holocaust survivors whose houses were filled with secrets or darkness. My parents only wanted to celebrate, only wanted to be joyful.
Look at yourself. You're talking to me now. And you're celebrating our meeting.
Yeah.
And the meeting is about healing.
Yeah.
And grieving.
So, Dr. Eger, you came here, you met your husband in Europe, and you came here, and then, as you say in the book, for decades, you were still a prisoner of the past. What was the incident that caused you to think about that differently?
Well, when I came to America, I didn't have $6 to get off the boat. And I had a little girl who just turned 2 years old. And I wanted to create an environment for her that she would think that the world is a safe place. So I went underground. I did not know. I didn't have the verbal capacity. And I did not know how to say it in Hungarian. By that time, she spoke Hungarian, she spoke Slovak, and she spoke German.
Mm.
And my two-year-old daughter. So she told me. So see, what we do with children, we parentize them.
Right.
We grow up very fast because you introduce to your parents peanut butter that I've never seen or heard of, or tuna fish. And so you go to the grocery store and your child is really teaching you how to become an American.
Mm-hmm. And
so that's why my question is, when did your childhood end?
Yeah.
Because we grieve over not what happened, but what didn't happen.
And I saw that question. I saw that question in the book, and I was very struck by, I had never heard that question put together. And what do you find among your patients is often the answer to that question?
Well, you know, sometimes I call myself a wandering Jew. You know, I kind of look up and say, I wondered about that. I don't throw up questions. I just keep wondering until I know where that person is, so I can keep that feeling company.
Mm-hmm.
I don't cheer up a depressed person, because if they tell me, and that's also in my book, In a Choice, that a patient came and the daughter was dying of hemophilia, and we were crying together, and the following hour another woman came in dying almost and crying because her Cadillac came in and it wasn't the color, that exact color that she chose.
Wow.
You see? So I don't compare, but I can tell you one thing for sure. The more you suffer, the stronger you become.
Mm.
I am not a strong woman. I am a woman of strength.
Right.
And I think Jewish people learn looking at life from inside out. And Auschwitz was a perfect place to develop your inner resources.
How many people do you think who survived something like Auschwitz could imagine thinking of it as a gift?
Well, when I asked my sister who was with me in Auschwitz to come back, she told me I'm an idiot.
Mm.
I am a masochist. It's not what happens, it's what you do with it. And that's why I can only speak for me. I am not saying we, I just say I felt, I did, I can only feel. And let you know that Auschwitz to me made me a very compassionate listener.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ask questions or give advice. I don't ask, how are you? I think that's the stupidest question, because people say fine, and they're not fine.
What's the better question?
No question at all. Questions can look like put someone on a witness stand. I say something like, gee, it's good to see you. How can I be useful to you?
Mm-hmm.
I don't say how help you. I don't help you. I don't work on you. I work with you.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes the dumbest thing around, I just keep wondering until they tell me all the information I want without asking any questions.
And probably because they know you're listening.
I repeat what I hear. Yes. Yes. I'm like a parrot. I hear you say, and then they say yes, or true or false. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, how many people do you think actually end up feeling heard?
Well, you know, I was professor of psychology, and one of my students told me that in America, people are hearing but not listening.
Mm-hmm.
There was even a brothers that were singing those days. And I said, well, let's test it. So tomorrow morning, you're going to pick up your books, yeah? So when someone comes and says, hi, how are you? You're going to say, my mother died this morning.
Mm.
Great, I'll see you this afternoon.
Yeah.
People are hearing, but not listening. I guide. I like that idea of a guide. Some people call me a spiritual midwife. And I thought, wow, that's not bad. It's okay. I'm happy.
That's a good job.
Isn't it good? It's a good job. It's not my job. It's my calling.
Yeah.
I don't have a job. I have a calling.
When did you decide? So when you came here, you became a teacher first. And then in your 40s, you decided to become a psychologist. That's not when you think about going to school. What was it that motivated you?
Well, the principal didn't like me because I was teaching psychology, and he thought that I'm brainwashing my students. And one student was smoking pot, and he got caught. He told the principal, it's funny that you bring back those memories. The principal thought that I'm brainwashing the kids because my students said, I don't give a damn about your school. I just want to go back to Mrs. Eager's class. And from that point on, oh my God. And I decided then that maybe it's time for me to think about getting a, yeah. And that was then. And I'm glad that I was also in medical school, and I wish I could have gone and have an MD and a PhD so I can work with medication, because sometimes just talking therapy doesn't cut it. You have to look at your genes, and you look at your bipolar and medication. That is very essential, along with talking therapy, but not instead of.
Yeah. Who would have thought that you'd have 4 to 5 decades of practicing as a spiritual midwife?
You know, I get up in the morning and I look in the mirror, and I think that it's a miracle that I'm still here.
Yeah.
And nothing, chronological age doesn't matter at all. Because you see, when I was 40, my supervisor told me to go get a doctorate. And I told him, it's impossible. By the time I get the doctorate, I'll be 50-ish. Mm-hmm. That you'll be 50 anyway. And I think that is a good thing. You'll be, go back to school.
Or
do belly dancing. Do something ridiculous that you avoided before. So that's why my name is not a shrink. I am a stretch.
Yeah. You have a lot of good lines.
My daughter calls it Ediism.
Ediism.
One of them is the opposite of depression is expression.
Yeah.
Because what comes out of your body doesn't make you ill. The second one is, are you evolving or are you revolving?
Yeah. And I want to go back. I want to go back to that first Ediism. We used to call my mother's Ibbyisms. Her name was Ibby.
It's the first time I hear that. I really appreciate.
Yeah.
You see, I'm not so original, thank God.
Uh-huh. So this concept that you talk about as one of the 12 lessons to free yourself, to give yourself a life of joy, is this idea of using your expression, giving into your rage and your anger in order to come out the other side. Explain more about that for me.
I think rage is very essential. I had a tremendous problem with anger. I did not know how to really go through the rage because it's very essential for you to acknowledge the unfairness of it all and shake your fist. I think God allows us to do that as long as we go through the valley of the shadow of death and not to get stuck in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're stuck, you're constipated. And when you're constipated, you concentrate on a movement. That's another. That's an idiom for them.
Edie, you're cracking me up.
Yeah, that's good. People compare me with Dr. Ruth and Joan Rivers.
Yeah.
Rivers tells you grow up.
Yeah.
I tell you the same thing. You want to be a baby or a big girl because there is no freedom without responsibility. It's anarchy.
Yeah, and you also talk about there's no freedom without going through
the rage.
Have you
through the rage?
And yeah, how do people do that? How do you do that?
Well, there are many ways that you can do that. You can actually put that person in a chair and do some gestalt, and you beat them up and you scream bloody murder and recognize that you can get addicted to it too.
Mm.
Not to do it in excess. Some people like chronically angry, not realizing that underneath of anger are other emotions that you may have not faced. And that's where I come in as a guide, to not talk about the pain, not to medicate the pain, not to do anything with the pain, but feeling the feeling.
Yeah.
There is no healing without feeling. And you got to go through that pain. And then there is a lot of other emotions like frustration, like anxiety. People tell me I have an anxiety attack. Where is the anxiety? Who is attacking? What we know scientifically is the way you get up in the morning and the way you go to the bathroom and look in the mirror and talk to yourself changes your whole body chemistry.
Mm. Are people shocked at that?
Actually, I am called also an ophthalmologist because I guide people from looking something or seeing something that you really see where you are in your life right now. Because if you're in midlife, you're crazy. It's full of craziness, but it's not a crisis. It's a transition. You don't have a problem. You have a challenge. So I kind of rewrite your script and say, I can give birth to the me that was meant to be free.
Yeah.
I'm very biased to freedom.
You know, I want to take a step back for a second, because the most astonishing, vivid description I can imagine of having a choice was you describing in the beginning of your book. It was May of 1945, and you were in a pile of dying and dead bodies. The 71st Regiment had come to liberate the camp that you were in, and you couldn't move a finger. And yet, you were confronted with the most base, frightening choices. And even in that circumstance,
you describe making a choice. Would you be kind enough to share with us that choice?
Well, as ill as I was, I noticed people go through the gate, and then pretty soon they would sit down because we were free, but we didn't know what to do with the freedom. You need to study Eric Fromm. I was with him myself because he about escape from freedom. Because, see, when you're a child, you sit in the back of the car and we mess around and your parents are driving. But when you're an adult, you have to decide whether you want to be driven or you want to be a driver.
Mm-hmm.
So we were brainwashed, and Seligman, Dr. Seligman, who is a kind of talking a great deal about positive psychology that I love myself, and talks about learned helplessness. We were so brainwashed that we didn't even know when freedom came. And that's what happens with battered wives. Their husband brainwashes them, and she believes it, that she's nothing without him. He makes her totally dependent on him,
right?
Because he is man enough to know that he wants someone who is thinking for herself, who is capable. And that's why I like modern marriages, because the pioneer woman worked alongside of her husband. But the industrial society, when a woman became emotionally and financially dependent on a man, the wife beating began. I did a lot of study, and I helped to build transitional living centers for battered wives. My life didn't start or end in Auschwitz. I think we can create our own concentration camp that is in our own mind, and the key is in your pocket.
And in the years of treating as many patients as you have, share with us a story of one where you doubted they could come out the other side.
I think it takes a lot of work.
Now, she's asking, could you re-ask the question?
Sure, of course. So in all your years of treating patients, and you describe many in your new book, The Gift. Was there a patient that you can recall where you were doubtful that they would be able to move through the process and feel free?
Well, I don't know what to do with the word doubt. You know, when doubt sets in your vocabulary, I don't know where to place it or what to do with that word doubt. I don't go there.
Mm-hmm.
I just go, I will do what's humanly possible, because people don't come to me. They're sent to me.
Oh. And sent to you by a referring doctor, by...
Yes, and look at the same thing from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same situation. I cannot change that. And this is what I will tell you about women. If you don't mind, I also became a diplomate in sexology.
Oh, good.
Alice. And so... what is happening to women that...
I think we froze for a second there.
What is... okay. First of all, when you're a little girl, you get different messages from little boys. The little boys are taught to become a doctor, the lawyer, the CPA, but the little girl will be taught to find somebody.
Mm.
Somebody who's going to take care of you, So you go from your father to another man. Okay, this is what's happening. That so they get married, and pretty soon the mother tells her, this is Nancy Friday. The book is called The Mother and Daughter, who tells the daughter on wedding day, tonight, think of England. It's something that you, it's your duty. So she doesn't want to go to bed with him. She really doesn't want to go to bed with him, but then she does because she thinks she should. And then she resents the fact that she does something she doesn't like to do. So she fluctuates from guilt to resentment. That's not good for you. Why? Because an orgasm prevents Alzheimer's. So have as many as you can.
That's got to be...
The word is called permission. Give yourself permission for pleasure.
All right, so Dr. Eger, I want your third book to be, the title to be, An Orgasm Prevents Alzheimer's. That will be a great book.
That's science. Use it, yes. If you don't use it, you lose it, you dry out like a prune. And so when you're 93, I can speak English the way I think might be something you want to look up to.
Yeah.
Same thing from a different perspective.
Yeah.
Because my husband is a klutz. He doesn't know a woman. He doesn't even know her anatomy. I asked one man about the clitoris, and he started to talk to me about the belly button. So I took pictures to show him. So that night he would go home with a flashlight looking there. I mean, that's not very sexy, is it?
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of a story when we used to go to the Catskills, my family. And I was like in third grade or fourth grade, and my mother thought she should teach me about getting a period. So she went to get a box of Kotex, and we were trying to read the instructions. She didn't read English that well still, and I could read English easily. And we're trying to figure out what the word vagina is. We never heard it because in our house it was called schmuncy. And so we go to somebody's house to get the English word to try to understand when you said that he didn't even know what a clitoris was.
Yes. Or a pussy.
Yeah.
Yeah. In Hungarian, if you say pussy, is you give a kiss.
A kiss. A kiss.
And one of my friends owned the department store and did some clothing for nuns. And he went to a nun and said, give me a pussy. And that, you know what he was talking about. You have to be careful.
You know, you talked about when you came to this country and your daughter, who was two then, it was Marianne, right?
And brilliant psychologist in New York City.
Marianne, who just had twin grandsons, right? And your great grandsons?
Exactly.
What are their names?
The name is Noah and Dylan. I don't know one from the other, totally identical.
What does that feel like?
It's going to bring picture.
What does that feel like to have great grandchildren?
I have seven great grandsons. I consider it my revenge to Hitler.
That's good revenge.
Oh, I don't think revenge is good at all. It's just very temporary.
Yeah. You going to show me a picture? Oh, my goodness. When were they born?
in San Diego.
April 7th? I'm April 3rd. The Aries are good. Aries are going to have a good time.
Well, you don't want April 20. That was my husband's birthday, and so was Hitler's.
Really?
The Columbine Massacre was on April 20th by Hitler worshippers, young people from the white supremacy group. You don't want April 20th. And you don't want children, unfortunately, join the white supremacy group.
Dr. Eager, before, you know, we've had a roundabout kind of conversation, but I want to make sure that our listeners hear from you that, you know, the powerful lessons that you share. The subtitle of your book is 12 Lessons to Save Your Life. Share with us some of these steps people can take to be able to live free lives.
Well, one of them is don't cover garlic with chocolate. You know, don't run away from the past. Don't try to fight it, to face it, to be able to revisit the places where you've been, to relive that experience. That's what I'm good for. So that's the second one would be, are you evolving or evolving?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I remember after the choice, people gave me all kinds of feedback that they want me to write a how-to book, a self-help book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the gift came about.
Right.
Okay. And it's very important. When you read the book, someone just sent me a beautiful email who, a wonderful woman, Susan Schutz, who did interview 6 white supremacy people who got out of the white supremacy group and tell how they were totally brainwashed and how they became very scared mm-hmm. that their freedom was completely taken away. So I think you will have to really find the Hitler in you and find the part in you that you acknowledge that self-love is self-care. It's not narcissistic.
Mm-hmm. Do people worry about that? Because I read that in the book where you talk about, you know, the need for self-care. How often do you find people resisting that because they think then that they're just selfish?
Well, you know, some people say, you know, I'm 93. I have 3 children. I have 5 grandchildren. I have 7 great-grandsons. I'm done. You're not going to hear it from me.
Right.
I'm going to say, what's next?
Right.
I'm curious. And that's what kept me alive in Auschwitz.
Yeah.
I never ever considered allowing the Nazis to murder my spirit that I bring you today.
Yeah.
That I discovered in Auschwitz. Auschwitz was a place for discovery, not recovery.
And tell us, Dr. Eager, your mother's words to you when you were in that despicable cattle car going from Hungary.
We were told we're going to Hungary to work on the fields. And my mom held me and she said, I always talk to young people. I'm totally committed to the young because they are the ambassadors for the future. I owe it to them because they are truly the future. So my mom told me, we don't know where we're going, we don't know what's going to happen. Just remember, no one can take away from you what you put here in your own mind. And that's exactly what happened. Everything taken away from me. And I had my mind. And I had my sister. That's what I say all the time when I go to the classroom, what my mother taught me.
And Dr. Eger, one of the things that I read is, which because I go to schools also to speak to junior high, and I have my parents' testimony. But I read a statistic. I wonder if you could affirm it or disaffirm it for me, that something like over almost 60% of the kids in school today have never even heard of the Holocaust.
I wouldn't be surprised, because who wants to think about something like that? But it's not comparable, because never in the history of mankind, 15 highly educated people celebrated at the end of the day, they are able to find a systematic and scientific way to put 30,000 Jews in the oven in one day. Unfortunately, we have genocide as we speak.
Right.
I don't know about numbers, but all I know that I am a part of the final solution of Eichmann, when people blindly adhere to authority. I highly recommend people to read Max Weber's book, Capitalism and the Protestant Ethic, when he refers to the Jewish people as pariah. So when you hear in Vietnam, you kill Gooks and Kikes, you give them a name and make them subhuman. It's just like rape. Has nothing to do with sex. It's debasing a person into an object and thinking that you're doing a favor to the world.
Right.
Because they took my blood in Auschwitz, and I was told they take my blood to aid the German soldier so they can win the war and take over the world. I was told that. I said to myself, you stupid idiot, with my blood, you're never going to win the war. So I think humor was extremely important.
Yeah.
So Joan Rivers to grow up. And that's why it's important to know there is no freedom without responsibility. It's anarchy.
Yeah. Dr. Eger, you wrote The Choice in 2017, and by my math, you were 90. What was it that at that age prompted you to sit down and write a book?
Well, many, many years people told me to write a book. And I would say automatically, I have nothing to say. And then Philip Zimbardo, who wrote the foreword, professor at Stanford, where I lectured several times, he told me the survivors who are famous today are all men, and they need a female voice. And I am a female voice of Viktor Frankl. But I'm not Viktor Frankl, because he was an MD already established when I was 16 in Auschwitz, and yet both of us used the same skills.
Right.
We checked out. I closed my eyes and I pretended that the music was Tchaikovsky, and I was dancing Romeo and Juliet, while he closed his eyes and imagined himself lecturing at the Viennese lecture hall about the psychology of the concentration.
Right.
People are raped, they check out.
Yeah.
I like to call myself really an ophthalmologist, to see them, that they are still innocent.
And the language that you use that I loved is, you talk about in the book finding not the new you, but the real you.
Exactly. Because we give it up early in life. You know, it's like Shakespeare. You will be the responsible one. You will be the funny one. And we give up our true self for a formula that doesn't work in midlife.
Yeah.
And I see my students, they don't know anymore who are they really. And I say, you are going to now give birth to the you that was meant to be free.
You know, in the book, you talk about one of your patients, and it was such a powerful story of you asking them to take the hand of their 8-year-old self and take and guide that 8-year-old self out from the house.
Yeah.
And the idea that you go back and find the moment when your childhood ended, mm-hmm. so that you can guide yourself with the help of someone like you, guide yourself out of that trapped childhood into a child that can become the real them, was just one of the most powerful things I think I had ever read.
Thank you so much. You're a brilliant interviewer because we want to look at the concentration camp that it's in our own mind.
Mm.
We were not to hate. We were born with love. We were born with joy. We were not born to judge anybody. We learn it. We are taught. So now you can do a little rotor with me, and we find out what you're holding on to and what are you ready to let go of.
Yeah.
That's my definition of love. The ability to let go.
Yeah, I love that. I love that idea. And, you know, I wonder what you think about, you know, there's a lot of new research recently on the transference of trauma and research on grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. What's your view on any of that thinking or research?
Yeah, there is a tremendous amount in the research. I follow it myself, what goes from generation to generation. I think you can stop it. But, you know, you carry that blood yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So your ancestors could have done things differently if they knew. So all you have to do with guilt is just to say, because my parents had tickets to go to America and they decided not to go because they did not know. So if they knew what they know now, they would have done things differently. So you must forgive yourself because you cannot change the past, and not to blame anyone and stop blaming and see not why me, but what now?
What now?
I live in the present. I can only touch you now.
And Dr. Eger, there's a beautiful picture I saw of you in a white bathing suit doing a split for your boyfriend, Eric.
Yes.
And there you were training for the Olympics. What would you say to that 16-year-old eating?
I would tell her that you're one of a kind, Diamond. Not really what I really felt when I was little, because my mother told me, I'm glad you have brains because you have no looks. I was I was cross-eyed. My sisters blindfolded me when they took me for a walk. And today I beg children in school not to allow anybody to define who you are. You're beautiful. You're unique. You're one of a kind.
So I'd like to close by reading your words. Life, even with its inevitable trauma, pain, grief, misery, and death, is a gift. A gift we sabotage when we imprison ourselves in our fears of punishment, failure, abandonment, in our need for approval, in shame and blame, in superiority and inferiority, in our need for power and control. To celebrate the gift of life is to find the gift in everything that happens, even the parts that are difficult, that we're not sure we can survive. To celebrate life, period. To live with joy, love, and passion. Dr. Eger Kusunem Sapin, for sharing.
Thank you.
For very sharing much.
A child of a survivor, I am really honoring today my parents with your parents.
Yeah.
We are to be sure that we'll do everything in our power that your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren will never experience.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Dr. Eger, the fact that you've written this book, that you've shared your story, not only directly with your patients, but all the readers of your first book, The Choice, and this book, The Gift, I would, you know, just urge people to read these books to understand that literally anything is possible. That, and we are the ones, what you're teaching us is we are the ones that can change our lives, nobody else.
And the willingness.
Yes.
The willingness to revisit the places where you've been and relive that experience. And not to get stuck in there.
Yeah.
I think you and I were meant to be here and we have a calling and I'm so happy to meet with you.
Yeah.
And also good role model to you. You have a long time to go.
Let's hope.
This is the evening.
I don't got that many years. So Dr. Eger, thank you so much for taking the time and, you know, just listening to you. You know, I feel like I'm talking to my mother, that voice and that accent. Your hands are even similar to hers. Who knows? Maybe Dr. Eger, maybe little Edie and little Ibby had met each other in Auschwitz. Who knows?
Maybe. We have, but I know now they're winking and they say, by God, she's got it.
Yeah, yeah.
Just remember, by God, she's got it.
Yeah.
And you got it, and I got it in us that we'll do everything in our power to do everything we can to unite and get rid of the us and them mentality.
Yeah. Dr. Eger, I want to wish you good health, that you see those great grandson twins thrive.
Yes.
Kusunem Sapin.
Nagyon szépen köszönöm. Isten áldja.
Isten áldja.
Yes.
Servus. Yes. We've been talking with Edith Eger, the author of The Gift, 12 Lessons to Save Your Life. Her new book that's out this year, and her previous best-selling book was The Choice, Embrace the Possible.
Just the Right Book is not just a podcast.
JustTheRightBook.com is a highly personalized book subscription service. It's good for readers of all ages. We have decades and decades of bookselling experience at RJ Julia's, and they're the ones who are selecting these books. Here's what happens. We get tons and tons of letters. We've been around for over 10 years, and the letters always are a version of this. I can't believe you picked out this book. I would have never picked it out. And guess what? It was just the right book. So visit justtherightbook.com for details and begin your subscription today. Of course, we have a promo code for you. So if you go to justtherightbook.com, use the promo code podcast, and you will get 15% off on your subscription at justtherightbook.com. You are listening to Just the Right Book with Roxanne Cody, brought to you by Lit Hub Radio. Produced by Roxanne Cody and Michael Selleck. Our editor is Gino Cordone at PleasantPodcast.com. The original theme music is by Kurt Feldman. You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can email me any comments, suggestions, observations. We would love to hear from you. Email me at podcast@rjjulia.com. I do hope you will subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Just the Right Book Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.